Greetings and welcome to Experiencing the Word, a Bible study ministry of Atonement Lutheran Church in Fargo, North Dakota. My name is Paul Cross, and I will be your guide through the Bible as we seek to understand God's plan for our lives and to learn life lessons from the pages of Scripture. In this season of study, we will focus our attention on Genesis, the first book of the Bible, the book of beginnings. If you would like to attend one of our studies, we meet at Atonement Lutheran, located at 4601 South University Drive here in Fargo. We meet on Wednesday nights at 6:30. But for now, join us in this recording of a live session of Experiencing the Word.
Amen. Just a couple things to remember. Tonight I'm going to ask you, if you had any takeaways, anything that was memorable for this time, do not be shy. Please don't. Or if you had any questions that remained unanswered, that's always an important thing, because sometimes things get left unanswered and you want to make sure that we get things done, because we're here to do that very thing. Then afterwards. I would encourage you to stay for snackies. We have some snackies tonight, so we can revel in snackies, and there'll be coffee and so forth. So that will be in the fireside room immediately following, so we encourage that. That should be a good time. You know, it's funny, the location of this church. It's funny. Why is it funny? The vault company's on one side. Well, the golf course is on the other side. And what's on the other side of the golf course? Cemetery. Yeah, you really don't have far to move those vaults, do you? Absolutely. They're kind of right there, and we're kind of right in the middle. What's up with that? Death is inevitable, and we're going to look at two deaths tonight, two deaths of two extremely significant figures. But let me ask you a question. What are some of the euphemisms? What are some of the ways people avoid speaking about death? What are some of the things that people say that they pass on? That's a favorite one. What else? Lost them. Yeah, what else? Departed. What was that? He's not gone, he's just away. Funeral homes are particularly good at this. They send the little things out that say, that ship is just sort of sailing over that way, and there's another shore, and you'll see the ship that has come. You've seen that one before, haven't you? Okay, all right. Any others? Laid to rest. There, that's a good one.
Gone home.
Kick the bucket. Oh, I like that. Yeah, absolutely. Do any of you remember... Do any of you remember the movie, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, in the early 60s? One of the scenes in there, I think it's Jimmy Durante, he actually kicks the bucket, when he dies. He's sort of shivering and goes, kicks the bucket there. Meet the Maker, that's another one, absolutely. Any others? Buy the Farm. Oh, Bought the Farm. That's one of my favorites. If I had a bowling trophy, I would give you the bowling trophy. Bought the Farm. That's a good one. By the way, if I had a bowling trophy, do you know what? I have to say it, Jar. I really do. If I had a bowling trophy, I'm feeling pretty cocky tonight. I want you to know that. I'm normally a very humble and modest person. You know that about me. But I'm feeling pretty cocky tonight because the youngsters... We went on a staff retreat this week, just yesterday and today, and they thought we would start out by bowling. So we were at the Battle Lake, was it Shoreview Restaurant and Lanes in Battle, or Shoreline Restaurant and Lanes in Battle Lake. And it's been numerous years since I've thrown a ball down the lanes, and I did pretty embarrassing the first time. Bought the Farm? To die. I have no idea. Kick the bucket. I don't know how to kick the bucket. Plant. You're planted. I don't know. But anyway, yours truly. Now, there are younger people, younger and more physically fit and so forth like this. And
I'm just going to talk about luck.
The old guy still got it in him. Yes, indeed. Of the whole, now Charles got it right. I am the fastest of the whole turtle group.
I have one thing to say.
Yes.
I kept score and I let him.
There you go. Anyway, it was a lot of fun. But anyway, bought the farm. I don't know what the derivation of bought the farm is. I mean, that's kind of a funny thing. Yes? The only rich farmer is a dead farmer. I never heard that. Nothing's paid off until then. Okay, well, there's that. If they put everything back into the farm, like quite literally. Well,
how about pushing up the daisies?
Pushing up the daisies is another one. That's another one. Well, tonight we're going to look at what I consider to be one of the more beautiful things. We just had Memorial Day, and I've mentioned to you before, it's a special day in my household because of my father's service and to this country, and being buried at Arlington National Cemetery, what a great honor. But I have to tell you something. Have any of you been to Washington, D.C., and seen the World War II Memorial? Late in coming. And they have 400 stars, or is it 4,000? But I think it's 4. But each star marks, if it's 400, they mark 1,000 fatalities, casualties in war. It's 400,000. And there's this, just a very simple line there that says, "Here we mark the price of freedom." Really powerful and poetic. Yes?
We looked up "He Bought the Farm."
Yes?
And it has to do with the English phrase, where they used to say "he bought the plot," which was mostly a way of stating that a soldier was killed. And after World War II, "he bought the farm" came into the American vernacular. So he bought the farm by giving up his life for his country.
There you go. Okay. The Googleographers pay off today. Yeah, thank you very much. That's good to know, because I didn't know that by any stretch of the imagination. Well, in any case, tonight we're going to learn what I consider to be perhaps the most poetic. He was gathered to his fathers. And there is this sense of ancestry. There is this sense of connectedness with generations that have gone before. But there's also a sense of being connected to the promise of God by being gathered to his fathers. Because what do we call Abraham? Father Abraham, that's how he's spoken of. We understand him to be, it's ironic because his name Abraham means father, exalted father, and then when it's changed, it's a father of a multitude. But he is the father of many. And so being gathered to the fathers is that sense of being connected to those people who have gone before us and ultimately being connected to the promise. Tonight we're going to be looking at the death of Jacob, that rascal, and the death of Joseph, his son, who was anything but a rascal. So we'll get to this right straight away. We left off here in Genesis chapter something or other, 40-something, 47, somewhere around there. Okay, Genesis 47. We dealt with the famine. Joseph blesses let's kind of deal with a few things first. As I said, being gathered to his people or being gathered to his fathers is this wonderful. In Genesis chapter 25, Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, a man full of years, and was gathered to his people. Genesis 25:17, these are the life of the years. Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last, and he was gathered to his kindred. And then with Isaac, he breathed his last and died, and he was gathered to his people, full of old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. I always loved that one because he was old and full of days, and he was 180 years old, and a lot older. A lot of time had passed since he said that he was going to die. Remember the last scene that we saw him in was with his cheating of Esau out of the birthright, And he says, I'm going to die. Well, he lives about another 80 years. I mean, it's just kind of funny. But hypochondriac, I guess, but need be that as it. Just saying. Jacob is about to die. He is going to be among his ancestors with his wife. Now, this is interesting. In spite of his love for Rachel, which is quite great, he decides that it's probably better to be married with Leah. Why is that? Couldn't tell you. But the best guess is that Leah's son, Judah, and again, why he gets the birthrights beyond me, that's probably because where he comes from. But let's turn our Bibles to Genesis chapter 48 and the 1st verse. And Keith, would you mind? Yes, Robert. We don't really know. Yeah, she's just along the way. Yeah.
So in the cave that was purchased by Abraham.
That's Leah. Leah's in that cave.
Yeah. So they were all buried in the same place, weren't they?
Doesn't say where Rachel was buried.
No, but Jacob or Joseph would be buried with the family.
Not yet. Not yet. We're going to find out about that. There's some interesting stuff that we're going to get to first. Let's read on, 48.
After this, Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is ill." So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And it was told to Jacob, "Your son Joseph has come to you." Then Israel summoned his strength and sat up in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you.'"
Does that sound familiar?
It does.
Be fruitful and multiply. That's what God's going to do. This is the activity of God's blessing. You will recall that the book of Genesis is not only a book about creation and a book about beginnings, but it's also primarily a book about blessing and the blessing of God that gets transferred down from generation to generation and God's desire for people to be blessed and to bless the earth. And that's, again, a helpful for reminder for us that our job, if you can call it that, is to be a blessing to other people. You have a purpose in life. You have a purpose in life. And that is to be a blessing to other people. You know, I think it's important for sometimes we forget that we put too much into our self-worth in other things without God, which is kind of crazy. Why do we do that? We should put more into that mission that God's giving us to be a blessing to others. Turn to just somebody, anybody. If you're sitting by yourself, turn to somebody and think about one of the ways someone else has blessed you that really has affected. Just kind of quickly do that. Just kind of turn to somebody and say, what's a good way that someone has blessed you that you think is pretty neat? You don't have to be shy. You can turn around. I got a better deal. You two are going to turn around and face these because you guys can't talk to each other. Yes. He really is a blessing, isn't he? He just absolutely is that. Absolutely.
Met yesterday or gathered.
Good. Yeah. That's good. Is it fun to talk about being blessed? Or is it awkward? Awkward, especially if you're a guy. You know what the men's prayer is, don't you? Come on, don't none of you watch Red Green? I'm a man, and I can change. If I have to, I guess. I'm surprised that Red Green has not penetrated this congregation. It's been on for, almost 25, 30 years. It's in reruns. None of you know what Red Green is? The Red Green Show? Oh, absolutely. That's this close to, you know, our northern border? Does it come on at 9 o'clock? Who knows when it comes on? I guess you've got Netflix. I don't think it's on Netflix. Well, let's read on. Okay.
Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a company of peoples, and will give this land to your offspring after you for an everlasting possession. Mm-hmm. And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, and as Reuben and Simeon are.
Okay, just as we said last week, the unbelievable blessing that is bestowed upon Joseph is that he sires two new tribes of Israel. As I mentioned before to you, the Israel had been Levi was going to be taken and sort of set aside as being priests to everybody, and so that shorts a tribe. So you'll need some. Well, Joseph, what do you do with Joseph? Well, Joseph's going to stop being a tribe. His two sons will take the place, and so that adds up there. So 2 minus 12, 12 minus 2 equals 10. You add two more, you still got 12. How about that? What a great deal, and what a great blessing to these two kids. Okay, read on.
And the children that you fathered after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. As for me, when I came from Paddan to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was still some distance to go to Ephraim, and I buried her there on the way to Ephraim, that is, Bethlehem.
So we don't know. It was on the way to Bethlehem somewhere. Okay? Now, this little parenthesis here is a helpful little thing here, because sometimes people wonder about this. And this is just kind of a no extra charge stuff for you. It's hard for us to imagine. I grew up reading the Revised Standard Version of the Bible. That is the Bible that I grew up reading. Now, the Revised Standard Version of the Bible differs somewhat from the Authorized Version of the Bible, which some people grew up reading, which came out in 1901, which differs significantly from the King James Version of the Bible, which some of you grew up reading, which was first written in 1611 and then revised a couple times. And just to kind of let you know, if you ever run into any King James onlyists, you know, people say you can only read the King James, you should ask them which version of the King James, because there are several, and the most recent one was published in 1769, and that's the one that most everybody has. The 1611 version of the King James would be unrecognizable to many because of the typefaces, and largely because of the spellings. The spellings were so odd, and so that it's kind of challenging. But what I'm saying is this, it's still the Bible, right? It's still the Bible. Well, sometimes we think that somewhere along the line, we get this goofy idea that the Bible came down in Hebrew, just sort of originally stamped, boom, there it is, and the Old Testament, there's your Old Testament, and then boom, stamped, there's your Greek New Testament, and so you got them, and we'll just translate them into English. Well, you think that's really how that happened? This happened over time. And things change over time. For example, he says, this place happened to me in Luz. Well, the place that they know it as is Bethel. Now, here he says Ephrathah. Now, then he says Bethlehem. Well, obviously, at some point in time, whoever's copying this down over generations recognizes that people don't know where Ephrathah is. But I know where Bethlehem is. It's in Pennsylvania. Read.
When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons whom God has given me here." And he said, "Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that he could not see. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your offspring also.
Isn't that beautiful? I mean, think of that for a second. Think of the humanity behind that. Here's a grieving father, a father who'd been grieving for at least, 15, 16, maybe 17 years, thinking that his precious son was dead, and then comes to find out that not only does he get to see his son, but he also gets to see his son's children. Now, there's a beautiful scene. Now, this is God at work. This is God at work. This is God doing his best work when we see this. And again, we get to see this from a God's eye view. Again, we get to see all the ironies that are here. We get to see all the hubris that's in people's lives, where their own strengths become their shortcomings. We get to see it all. But here we get to see this incredibly tender moment. Sometimes I think we forget that about the Bible. Sometimes we look to the Bible just simply to have as a bunch of lists of do's and don'ts and thou shalt nots and thou shalls. But no, it's a beautiful story, and talks about this really tender moment that is expressed right here. It really gives us a glimpse of God's heart. Okay? All right, read on.
Then Joseph removed them from his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh to his left hand towards Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
And he blessed Joseph.
Can you imagine what's going to happen right here? Yeah, anybody got any ideas what's going to happen? Have you seen the pattern? No. Again, there's the notion of the firstborn getting everything, right? But you can just guess what's going to happen. Read on.
And he blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys, and in them let my name be carried on, in the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth.
Okay. Now, what's interesting is you will see that these are two of the most when they leave Egypt, Ephraim and Manasseh become two of the most populous tribes. Manasseh is actually so populous is that he needs two sections of inheritance. He has an inheritance. The descendants have an inheritance on the eastern side of the Jordan River, as well as one on the western side of the Jordan River. They become so populous in that blessing. And take a look at that blessing right there. That's really something. Look at that. It says, the God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day. Keep our thumb there. And let's go to where your Bible opens automatically. You know where it's at, don't you? Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. What do you think of when you think of that? What's your reaction to hearing the 23rd Psalm?
Many use it at funerals.
Oftentimes. It talks about being in the shadow of the valley of death. Yeah, okay. What else? What are some of your other reactions? There's a confidence of the years to come, of the years ahead. Absolutely, there's a confidence of the years ahead. What else does this say to you? So it's an incredible blessing, an inclusive of all the blessing that God has in our life. That's true. That's great. Other thoughts about this? Yes.
You remarked one time before that we came across in earlier in Genesis a mention of an angel. And I see there's another one.
Sure. So you're holding what I said against me, huh?
And the angel has redeemed him.
That's yes. That is a very unusual statement. The angel has redeemed him, or there's that sense of protection, but that is very unusual. But yes, there is this sense of the angels of the Lord. About the Bible says in Psalm 34, the angels of the Lord encamp those around those who fear him. Absolutely. You have, others? That,
comfort in death.
Comfort in death. Okay. Yes. Dwelling in the house of the Lord forever, that sense of there is a place for me that I, you know, that I don't have, my home's not here. You know, we value our homes, but you know what they are? They're drywall and 2x4s. The home that we have that God has for us is not. Yes?
It's unconditional.
It's unconditional, exactly. You know, again, this crazy idea of unconditional grace in the Old Testament. Where did that crazy idea come from? Yes. Any others? You know, here's the funny thing about this particular psalm. As beloved as it is, it's not quoted in the New Testament. Now, the New Testament quotes a lot of psalms. And as a matter of fact, it quotes Psalm 118 a lot. As a matter of fact, Psalm 118, I believe, is the most quoted Old Testament passage in the New. But Psalm 23 is not. Isn't that funny? And yet it is really indelibly etched into our cultural consciousness. Let me tell you a funny story about this. Not everybody goes to church. Did you know that? Not everybody goes to church. Matter of fact, fewer and fewer people are going to church. That's kind of sad. We talked a lot about that at the staff retreat. But not everybody goes to church, and not everybody knows the Bible. I had a situation many years ago where I had to do a funeral for a woman who I would pay visits to. She was in a nursing home, and she was marginally connected to the church that I was serving. And Her kids were, well, they were not churchgoers. As a matter of fact, one of them had to get special permission to get out of the workhouse so that they could be at her funeral. So, I mean, you know, I mean, things like that happen in life. But I'm sitting down with the family and ask, is there any Bible verse that you would like to have read at her funeral? And you could hear the crickets chirping. And finally, one of them said, isn't there something in there about green pastures? I just thought, yeah, there is. We'll go with that. We'll use that as a starting point. We'll start there. Okay. So, and that's. But I mean, but even among people who are deeply, deeply, deeply unchurched, at least somewhere in our cultural consciousness, there's this, which brings me back to Genesis, because in Genesis we have that indication that God has been my shepherd. Notice there's that sense of my. You know, there's that possessive sense that God is my shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. Now, if you think about that, you know, Mr. Whiskers is my cat. Mm-hmm. Right? Mr. Whiskers. No, I don't have a cat named Mr. Actually, he would be named Sergeant Whiskers if he was my cat. Sergeant Whiskers is my cat, which would mean, well, actually, that's not a very good... Fido or Nero is my dog. Because, as you know, dogs have owners and cats have staff. Yeah, just how it works. But I mean, there is this sense of that God is, that the dog is mine, right? That sense of mine. What's that relationship, the Lord is my shepherd? What's that indicate? I'm the what? I'm the sheep. Are the sheep the owners? No, the shepherd is. I belong to God. What a beautiful thought to say that. That God is my shepherd means I belong to God. And God, and what do shepherds do? Shepherds look out. Shepherds have a thing. What's that thing called? Staff. And on the one hand, it's got a what? A crook. And on the other hand, it's just straight. That crook is for yanking the sheep back in line when they get in line. That staff, other end, is for beating the crap out of the wolves that come around. That's what it's for. It's for whacking on the bears and the lions that want to have themselves mutton for dinner. It's good. Too bad Becky's not here. Did you know that Becky's family raised sheep? Yeah, that's pretty neat to talk about with her. And that this was a big deal. She was telling true tales. You know, if Becky ever has you over for dinner, be careful what you're eating there. Because, you know, she'll tell you it's pork. She was saying that they'd have people over for dinner, they have a leg of lamb, and they wouldn't tell them it was a leg of lamb until after dinner because they just loved it. Because, you know, people are kind of, they don't want to eat it because they're so cute. I mean, as I said, we don't want to think about eating little cute things. But the idea of the Lord being my shepherd, again, expresses this very intimate relationship of care and concern and protection. And that is what Jacob is professing, that God is shepherd and that we can look to God that way. Now, isn't it amazing that Jacob is doing this centuries before David looks upon God in the same way, and even, you know, a millennia and a half before Jesus says in John chapter 10, I'm the good shepherd. So we see this theme that runs throughout, this metaphor of protection. Now, we don't have sheep much around here, do we? I mean, maybe some people have some, but I mean, it's not like we're living in New Zealand or anything like that, you know, where there are more sheep than there are people. Yes?
I want to tell you something even more remarkable compared to yesterday in our North Dakota history.
Yes.
In 1963,
North Dakota Agricultural College. First year of college Spanish, memorizing the 23rd Psalm. You got to like that. Was it in Spanish? Well, there you go. That would make sense. You probably wouldn't have done it if it wasn't in Spanish. Tell me what the word shepherd was in Spanish.
Well, I'll recite a little bit of
I think I know.
Pastor,
yeah. There you go. Absolutely. Pastor. That's true. Pastor does mean shepherd. And there's no two ways about it. So, which end of the staff do you want, friends? I can do either one. But actually, I have one. Somebody gave me one. It was kind of cool. Another pastor, a retired pastor, gave me a staff. But he had modified it to put a little ring in the middle, a wooden ring in the middle, upon which there is a towel to remind that the shepherd's staff is also for those who wash the feet of others in servanthood. So it's kind of neat. Yes?
Well, I'm thinking out loud for myself here.
Yes. We're allowed to do that.
When you think about the 23rd Psalm.
When you think about the 23rd Psalm.
God takes care of me. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to think in terms of that, what my body wants, what my body needs.
Yes.
He's really promising what my soul and what my spirit needs.
He's promising what our soul and spirit needs. That's true. But he's using a metaphor that's about our bodies, you know, lying down by green pastures. Did I tell you the story about the bison and the cross family? I'll tell you later. It was in Custer State Park. And, you know, bison like green grass and meadows just as much as campers do. You know, campers like to camp in the green grass and the meadows. Well, it was late at night, and we had pitched our tent, and all we heard was... When we woke up in the morning, the dew had been disturbed right up next to our tent and mowed down, but the bison didn't knock over the tent. I mean, it was amazing. So they like the green. They like being laid down behind green pastures as well. Oh, let's get back to Genesis. It says, the angel of the Lord has redeemed me from all evil. The angel who has redeemed, this is God's angel, has bought him back, has redeemed him from all evil. God has agents of protection. This is something that I think that people don't think about. We can't see angels, or we don't think we can. Sometimes we can. What does angel look like in your world? Tell me what angel looks like in your world. Or how are angels often depicted, maybe? Just wings. Halos. Glowing and glowing, absolutely, yes. Young. You think they look like people?
Because they're messengers, and I think when God sends them.
You mean they look like me?
Yeah, we talked about angel unawares and I once experienced it. They had deer orange things on their going hunting.
Okay, deer orange things going hunting. I don't doubt it.
I don't know how else it could happen. Because that was
just so strange. Wow. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Got me out. Brother, are you looking and thinking she's crazy?
No.
I shared it before. And I got in a car, and as they pushed me out, and I turned to thank him, and there was no one there.
Of course. Because I believe that happens to a lot of people. A lot of people, stuff like that happens too, where we have an angelic encounter, and, you know, like you were saying, there's these two guys in a truck, look like they're deer hunting, and turn around to thank them, and they're gone. Yes?
I had an experience like that. Mm-hmm. 1997, we were running close to Dallas, Alabama.
Yep.
And we were in Finland, mm-hmm. and the air base had been closed at that time, the little air station out there, but they were trying to resurrect it. So they could take people.
Sure.
There were 20,000. And one of the things, I don't know how I got on that particular detail, but I took my car and went to Grand Forks. We were looking for departments. We were looking for maps and box breaking.
Sure. Okay.
When I got to this place, all I had was a pickup, I think, my pickup for a car. And there was a man who was also in there, and he said, where are you from? And I and he said, oh, Chuck, I've got a great big trailer out there. He said, and I said, I'm going to call some people back home to see if they can come with farm trucks. And both of them said, oh, you need to load up my trailer. And so they loaded up the trailer with cribs and dresses and diapers.
Sure. You know, I can't tell you the number of times I've heard stories like that from people. It's amazing. It's cool, and the Bible talks about angels in that sort of where I had to. While I was chuckling, I just want you to know because you said angels unawares. I'm going to tell you two funny things real quick. One funny thing and one good thing. Would you mind, fellas, quickly looking up Hebrews chapter 13, verse 2, which is where that passage is? Hebrews chapter 13. Two funny things, one funny thing and one serious thing, because it fits right in. It dovetails right in with our staff retreat that we were talking about. You there, Phil? You there? 13:2.
13.
13:2. Yeah.
Oh, 13.
Hebrews 13:2.
Okay, I'm with you.
I know you are. I trust you. 13:2 says. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers.
For thereby
some have entertained angels unawares. I had a secretary who was from Iger Township in North Dakota. Anybody know where Iger Township is? Maybe it doesn't exist. Maybe Edna was just sort of lying to me. But Edna Ringerud, she was my secretary for years and years in at the church in Fridley, and we would just go around and around and around and around. And on leaving, she gave me a going away present, and she found some old GI issue woolly woolly itchy itchy olive drab long johns, and she put a little sign on them. It's called them Angels Unawares. But is your thumb still there?
Yeah.
Read what it says.
Again,
yeah.
Do not neglect to show hospitality
to your good friends, to the people you know really well,
yeah,
who you're glad to see in church.
Yeah.
What did it say?
For
to who?
Strangers.
Strangers.
Yeah.
Okay, friends, I want to tell you something. There's a huge difference between being a friendly church and being a welcoming church. A friendly church says hi to all your friends. And what's kind of our natural reaction? We want to say hi to all our friends. That's not what a welcoming church does. We're not called to be a friendly church per se. What are we called to be? Welcoming. We're to entertain strangers. We're to show hospitality to people who we don't know. Now, I got a challenge to you. This is going to kill you. This is going to absolutely kill you. You're going to scream and you're going to say, oh, why is he making us do this? Your job next Sunday is to say hi to three people you don't know before you say hi to one person you do. How about that? What, you don't know me? I've known you. Well, let's see how it works. I have a pastor friend of mine who pastors a large church in one of the exurbs of the Twin Cities, and that's what he tells his people. Say hi to three people you don't know before you say hi to one you do. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. Some of you, by the way, I know in this room, are very, very good at that. I want you to know that. But as I said, I want you to get better at that, because that's what we're charged with, is to show that hospitality towards people who... that's how they'll know we're Christians, okay? All right, let's see. It says, and the angel has redeemed me from all evil. And boy, he experienced evil. And what else does it say? And bless the boys. And in them let my name be carried on, in the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac. And let them grow into the multitude, into the midst of the earth. Woo! Good stuff. That's a blessing. Read on.
When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him.
Yes.
And he took his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head.
Apparently he didn't know the family history.
And Joseph said to his father, "Not this way, my father. Since this is the firstborn, put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said,
"You know how that works.
I know, my son.
You know how fathers love to be told what to do by their sons."
"He also shall become a people, and he shall also be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations." So he blessed them that day, saying, "By you, Israel will pronounce blessings, saying, God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you again to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you, rather than to your brothers, one mountain slope that I took from the hand of the Amorites with my sword and with my bow."
Now, we don't know where this thing is at. That's what would be nice to know, but there's all sorts of things. about where that particular piece of real estate is. So that's kind of what we what here to the situation. So he blesses these two guys. Then what he does this, and then so in verse chapter 49, verse 1, then Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall happen to you in days to come." So there's some stuff that's going to happen. And what we have in chapter 49 is an exceedingly lengthy discussion about the blessings of each of the children of Israel. Read on.
Then Jacob,
verse 2, okay. Assemble.
Assemble and listen, O sons of Jacob. Listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the first fruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed and then you defiled it. He went up to my couch.
You know, as it said, as I told you before, Numbers 23, be sure your sin will find you out. Here it is. You had this, but sorry, that's not what's going to happen, and that's your deal there, Reuben. Okay, read on. Next one.
Simeon and Levi are brothers.
Two guys together.
Weapons of violence are their swords.
When did you last see them together? Do you remember? With Dinah. Don't you remember Dinah? Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah. Someone in the kitchen I know. Shechem's in the kitchen with Dinah. Oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. Well, that's what happened, wasn't it? And there was some shaking going on, and then there was some clippity-clipping going on, right? They were getting the clippity-clip. And what happened? Simeon and Levi went through and wiped them all out, all those Shechemite types. So a lot of fun there. You'll have to explain this to them afterwards, okay? So I'll let you do that. So, okay. All right, read on.
Let my soul come not into their counsel.
Mm-mm.
O my glory, be not joined to their company.
Mm-mm.
For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen.
Mm.
Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel.
Okay, just so that you know, because sometimes people make this mistake, there's a difference in the Bible between what's descriptive and what's prescriptive. Something that is descriptive is simply describing what happened. Okay? Something that is prescriptive is prescribing how we should live. You know, yes, it's humorous to think about the things, the bitter irony of the Hamorites and the Shechemites that are dying because of their indiscretion. However, it is not necessarily prescriptive of God. And so he says, guess what? Sorry, this isn't how it works, okay? All right, read on.
Judah, your brothers shall praise you.
Judah means praise.
Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you.
Mm-hmm.
Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up.
Mm-hmm.
He stooped down, he crouched as a lion and as a lioness. Who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah.
Okay, first of all, the lion business. Jesus is often referred to, or David, as the Lion of Judah. You've probably heard that before. Well, this is where it comes from. Just to let you know, large cats, lions, were indigenous to that part of the world at that time. It's amazing to see the kind of the range of how big cats at one time lived. I'm fascinated. I'm a big cat person. Sorry, all you dog people out there. You know, I know you think ill of me because I'm a cat person. I'm a cat person, however, without cats. I have no cats. And yeah, isn't that strange? Because I know better. Why would you want to keep cats? You ever had to clean a cat box? And holy cow, yeah. They're always bringing dead things home and putting dead things on your doorstep until you come out and trip over it. And when they see that you tripped over it, then they just destroy it. You ever had cats do that? Cats do that all the time. It's crazy stuff. This another cat thing. Somebody, you know, a cute little domestic cat. People put critter cams on them and then let them outside. They're just the most lethal killing machines you can possibly imagine. Killing moles, birds, everything. They're just unbelievable. These are house cats. You think, oh, they're such cute little kittens. No, they're lethal killing machines. Anyway, David is the Lion of Judah. And they, you know, you will see stories later on when we get to Israel's history, which will be in 2 years. just saying, just telling you when the plan is. You got to have a plan. If you don't have a plan, you're not going to get there. And you'll see there's a great story about how a lion kills a disobedient prophet. And you think, lions, he's not up in Africa. Because normally you think of lions being in Africa. But no, they were certainly in this part of the world at that time. So, Lion of Judah, pretty a regal animal. Read on.
The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet.
Okay, scepter and ruler's staff are parallels. They mean the same thing. What a scepter was. You got any idea what a scepter is? What's it look like? It's a stick? With a what? Something on top, yeah. And what's on top typically? Yep.
Some type of gem? Or
No. Crown? Jewels. Big honking jewels are on it. You see, what it is what a scepter is in fact a bejeweled war club. That's what it is. It shows power. It's got jewels on it. It shows the authority and power of that person, because back in these days, the person with the most power and strength was the king. And so the most fitting thing for a king to have as a sign of his office was a crown and a club that looked pretty spiffy, more spiffy than anybody else's club. Well, apparently, Judah's club is quite spiffy, to say the very least. Read on.
Nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples, binding his foal to the vine and the donkey's colt to the choice vine. He has washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes.
Mm.
His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk.
These are prefigurations of someone who shall come from Judah. Anybody got any ideas? Jesus, all the wine and blood images there. So there you have that right there. Okay, keep reading there.
Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea.
I thought he was going to discover Pike's Peak.
He shall become a haven for ships. And his border shall be Sidon.
Did you know that Zebulun Pike was also the founder of Fort Snelling? Did you know that? He was there. So just to kind of let you know that. All right. Just saying. I mean, come on. You can Google that, you Googleographers. Look that up on Wikipedia.
Issachar is a strong donkey crouching between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant. So he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant at forced labor. Mm-hmm. Dan shall judge his people.
Dan means judge.
As one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that the rider falls backwards. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Raiders shall raid Gad, but he shall raid at their heels.
Mm-hmm.
Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield.
By the way, Gad
royal
sounds
delicacies.
Like to raid. It sounds like a word meaning to raid. Okay.
And he shall yield royal delicacies. What is it? Naphtali?
Naphtali,
okay. Is a doe let loose that bears beautiful fawns. Joseph
Naphtali means he gives beautiful words. So the idea that each of these has a blessing related to somehow to his name in many cases. Okay.
Joseph is a fruitful bough, a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely. Yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father, who will help you, by the Almighty, who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breasts of the womb, blessings of your father and mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers.
Okay, now this is an interesting thing here. Joseph gets a far bigger blessing than Judah does. Did you see that there? And it's far cooler. He says, these are some great things that are going to be bestowed upon you. It sounds messianic in many ways, which of course is strange because the promise of the Messiah goes through Judah, even though Judah, as we know, is a rat. At least what Genesis tells us about Judah is that he's kind of a shady character. Nevertheless, what's the last one? Last but not least.
Benjamin is a ravenous wolf, in the morning devouring the prey and at the evening dividing the spoil.
Well, there you go. Absolutely. So, any questions about that? Yes.
Right. The passage describes Jacob pronouncing these blessings.
Yes, it does.
But did he have prophetic powers to make those blessings even come true?
Well, of course he doesn't have one does not have prophetic powers to make something come true. One has prophetic powers because God has given them the gift of prophecy, and God makes it come true.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do we make of, for example, the blessing for Zebulun?
Sure.
Which says you've got ships and he's by the sea.
Yep.
And when we go look at a map, we see that Zebulun was landlocked.
Well, you know, it what we see of it might have been. Now, the thing is, this might be the prophetic promise of it. Can I ask you a question? Have you read the book of Joshua? Have you read the book of Judges? How good a job do they do carrying out God's will of conquering the land?
Not so good.
Not so good, right? See, there you go. So they don't do such a great job. He says, here's what you could have. Now go out and get it. Does he go out and get it? Not so much. The thing is that oftentimes, you know, when it says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, that's true in our lives. We fall short. Falling short's not fun. I mean, it's miserable. But it's true. It's what happens. We fall short, which is why it's great to have the grace of God in our lives, because that promise that we have from Romans is that while all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, that God's grace is available for us all. So, but that's kind of where I see that. Yeah, they didn't do such a great job of conquering the land, did they? No.
How about the flag, the last king of Ethiopia was called the Lion of Judah?
Okay, why was the last king of Ethiopia called the Lion of Judah? You mean our good friend Haile Selassie? You know, I feel about as sassy as Haile Selassie. If I were king, wouldn't mean a thing. There's an old song that goes that. Yes, indeed. Shanty Town is the name of the song. Just to let you know. All right. Well, it gets crazier. If you want to get really crazy, how many of you are familiar with a gentleman by the name of Bob Marley? Yep. Bob Marley, a Rastafarian and Jamaican of Rastafarian acclaim. Also a singer known for his reggae-type music. But the Rastafarians worshipped Haile Selassie, who was the last king of Ethiopia. As an hereditary title, the king of that was Lion of Judah. And people say, well, why is that? Anybody hazard a guess? No. We could fast forward to, say, First Kings. First Kings, and I think it's chapter 4. Something. I think that's what it is. I could be wrong about that. Let's find out. Let's go there, just for the fun of it, since you asked. First Kings, since you asked. Okay, First Kings 4. Oh, I'm getting old here.
Um,
No. I said four, but that's probably not it. I'm trying to find it right here. That's what I'm thinking. Well, what it is that the Queen of Sheba comes. The Queen of Sheba comes to him and is amazed that all this stuff's going on. Now, there is some debate about exactly where Sheba is. Some suggest that Sheba is in modern-day Yemen, but historically, people have suggested that Sheba is in modern-day Ethiopia. Chapter 10. All right, well, there you go. Man, I tell you, so I'm slipping a cog there. Put me out to pasture, for crying out loud. Put me out to pasture, or the shepherd, whatever. Chapter 10. So we've got the Queen of Sheba coming. Well, the Shebians, or the Ethiopians, actually say, well, you know, when Sheba came, you know, there's a whole lot of shaking going on. It says, now this one I know. See what it says in chapter 11 of 1 Kings. This one you're not going to trick me up on. What does it say there? Chapter 11, the 1st verse. Now, all of the King James says, Solomon knew many strange and foreign women. Knew meaning the biblical sense of know, basically the yada. I heard somebody again saying, yada, 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 not without knowing what they're talking about. And they were on staff, too. I didn't have the heart to correct them in front of God and the rest of their staff members. Yes, at a staff meeting, a lot of yada, yada, yada going on. Holy cow, who would have thought? But nevertheless, yeah, so Solomon knew many strange and foreign women. They make the connection here. The Ethiopian dynasty has always contended that Sheba, the Queen of Sheba, had a child who became royalty after her through Solomon. And therefore, he is the Lion of Judah. It's interesting, the connection between the Ethiopians and the Bible is significant, and the Ethiopian church specifically is of a very interesting sort of thing. Christianity in Ethiopia is a fascinating, fascinating study. So that's the answer to your question. That's why he was called that. The Ethiopian monarchy was the longest continuous monarchy in the history of the world. No monarchy lasted longer. He was captured by the Italians. I think the Italians imprisoned him. But it was the communists that did him in when the communists took over Ethiopia. Now, why should Bob Marley be and the Rastafarians worship Haile Selassie and the King James Bible? That's beyond me. I don't know. They also worship ganja, too, so whatever. So there you go. Okay, let's move on. Okay? Enough nonsense. I'm supposed to get this thing done tonight. Do you think I'm going to be able to get done with another chapter in this time? We'll see. We'll see. All right. Chapter 49. Why don't you pick it up to where we were, okay?
Okay. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with the blessing suitable to him. And then he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people.
Mm-hmm. There it is right there. I am to be gathered to my people. That's why we started out this way. We talked about that. Okay.
Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron, the Hittite. In the cave that is in the field at
Machpelah.
Machpelah. To the east of Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites.
You notice he says that three times. He wants to make sure, hey, we got this from the Hittites. Don't let the Hittites tell you, hey, where's the title deed to this place? We bought this thing from the Hittites, okay? Read on.
When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people.
Now there's a beautiful thing. He was gathered to his people. And thus comes the end in a very strange way, in a roundabout way to the, as I told you, these things blend into each other. These stories blend into each other's life. We've seen this unbelievable story of Joseph's life, but there was some unfinished business. And the Bible is filled with this unfinished business. We're going to see that in a minute. And that's what I love about the Bible. It's got unfinished business to it. And so there was this unfinished business. What happened to Jacob? This guy who was bigger than life, whose escapades were both hilarious and tragic at the same time, whose escapades looked like ours. I mean, you could see your own self in them. I mean, here's a sinner after our own heart, a guy that we can relate with. But in the end, this beautiful ending for him, he is with his sons all together there, and then he is to be gathered to his people and laid to rest with his fathers and his wife in this beautiful place. Boom. Not quite. Read on.
Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father.
To do what?
Embalm.
Now, who are the physicians? What? Egyptians. Embalm. Mummify. They're going to make him a mummy. Interesting. Read on.
So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming.
Now, we don't know anything about, well, I shouldn't say anything, we know very little about the exact process of how they were able to do this. This is kind of interesting that we have sort of an eyewitness account to this. Not the technical aspect of it, but the time that was required. That's kind of an interesting little side note. Read on.
And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Mm. And when the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, 'My father made me swear, saying, I am about to die. In my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan, there shall you bury me. Now, therefore, let me please go up and bury my father, then I will return.' And Pharaoh answered, 'Go up, bury your father, as he made you swear.' So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as the household of Joseph, his brothers, his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company.
Mm.
When they came to the threshing floor at Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, 'This is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians.' Therefore the place was named Abel-Mizraim."
Mm-hmm. The mourning of the Egyptians. Mizraim means Egyptians. Okay.
"It is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had commanded."
By the way, the phrase "beyond the Jordan" is kind of curious there. Where's beyond the Jordan? No. Jordan. This is in the Promised Land.
Yeah.
If you're beyond the Jordan, and you're saying beyond the Jordan, and you're talking about a place that's in the Promised Land, you know what that must mean?
You're in the Promised Land.
No, you're not.
You're not.
Because if you're saying that place is beyond the Jordan, it's on the other side of the Jordan, and that place is in the Promised Land, it means that you're not. Who wasn't in the Promised Land? Who was alleged to have written the book of Genesis? Moses. Did Moses ever set foot in the Promised Land?
No.
Again, if you're writing it from this perspective, now a lot of critical scholars say that this was not written by Moses, it was written by people later on and all this sort of stuff. No, you're writing this from the perspective of looking across over into the promise of God. You're standing, the person that wrote this is standing outside the Promised Land and has to look beyond the Jordan into the Promised Land. That's kind of interesting. It validates the idea that Moses is the author of the book of Genesis. Well, yeah, I suppose you could say that. I mean, if you're writing a story, but if you're actually writing something that just says, well, it's beyond the Jordan, you say, well, there it is. It's over there. I'm not there yet. Sure. Okay. All right. Read on.
Thus his sons did for him as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah to the east of Mamre, which Abraham had bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place.
Boy, they say that a lot, don't they? Yeah.
After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father.
Now that's interesting. The brothers go back to Egypt, largely because all their flocks are still back there, but they go back to Egypt even though it's not their home. They were the guys that grew up in Canaan, but they go back there. Joseph spent most of his life in Egypt. So there we have a beautiful account of the death of Jacob. So we put another patriarch to rest. And there's one yet that remains, our friend Joseph. Let me read this to y'all. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." At least now they now recognize that they did a lot of evil to him. Is not that correct? And so they're worried. Isn't that human nature? Isn't that human nature that we expect to be paid back for the evil that we have committed? We expect the worst, right? Is it a good thing to expect the worst? Some people think so. But be that as it may, so they sent a messenger to Jacob saying, "Say, your father gave this command before he died." It's a lie. It's a lie. It's a lie. "Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgressions of your brother and forgive the transgressions of their sin because they did evil to you. Now please forgive your transgression of your servants, the God of your father, Joseph." Joseph wept when they spoke because he thought, you can't think I'm that stupid to believe this. When they spoke to him, that's not what he said. But his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants," or "Behold, we are your slaves." They recognize that this is trouble now, because it used to be they had the power of distance. Then they had the protection of their father. Now they have neither distance nor their father to protect them. They are naked before the wrath that they have incurred for their sin. Yes. Yep. Yes. They're bowing to him again, a double dream that has a double fulfillment. How about that? Pretty cool. Okay. And then, "But Joseph said to them, 'Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant it for evil against me. But God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today.'" God is a far better chess player than you can possibly imagine. No matter how good you are at thinking you play chess, God is better. These jabrons are doing this because they're doing truly out of evil. And Joseph recognizes that, and Joseph says that, "You jabrons did this because you had evil intent in your hearts. But God was going to turn that for good. Because God's a better chess player than you, and God has a plan of incredible blessing." And think of the blessing that God did through Joseph in this time. It's amazing. "Your father..." See, "so do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted and spoke to them. Okay. Now, a couple things about this book. First of all, the brothers' plan. They fear because they were schemers. Scheme number one, they threw Joseph in a well to leave him to die. Scheme number two was to take Joseph out of the well and sell him into slavery. Scheme number three was to cover their tracks of the first two schemes by deceiving their father. Scheme number four, to trick the brothers the first time with regard to the sale of grain. Scheme number five, trick the brothers a second time with regard to the sale of the silver cup. Scheme number six, attempt to deceive Joseph with regard to the brothers' last wishes. Scheme, 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 scheme. The schemers are come to an end. They've made up this fabrication to cover themselves. Joseph's response, on the other hand, has a God's eye view of things. And friends, can I tell you something? This is how we should live our lives, with a God's eye view of things, not with a human's eye. Did any of this not happen? All of it happened. And sometimes we think of the evil and the rotten stuff that happens to us, and we think of it with a human's eye view. We'll try to make up some excuse or some scheme to cover our tracks instead of looking at it through a God's eye view. And that's so important for us, because when we carry the weight of that along with us. Those brothers carried that weight along it right up until the point they found out the grain, and even beyond that. When they found out who it was giving the grain, they realized they'd been found out. When they saw grace, they saw grace. But apparently it didn't stick, because they had to come up with this, you know, scheme number two to lie to Joseph about what their father had said. They didn't need to do that, because Joseph had a God's eye perspective about things. It's important for us to see that. Now, with regard to the death of Joseph, he is blessed seeing his great-great-grandchildren, and there is indeed an irony of it. Now, Joseph's life is, interestingly enough, a foreshadowing of Christ. The entire life of Joseph's story is a story of death, or at least perceived death and resurrection. We have the death and resurrection of the well, right? We have the death and resurrection of prison. And we have the death of being sold out of his father's household into slavery, into the resurrection of being revealed to his father's household as ruler of Egypt. And to his father, Joseph is truly one who is brought back from the dead. So in the story of Joseph, we see a story of death and resurrection. It's a foretaste of what we're going to see as the main theme of the Bible, but also the main theme of our lives. Do you know why? You know what God's business card says? God has a did you know that God has a business card? I mean, everybody's got a business card, don't you? I mean, if you're in business, you got to have a business card, right? You know what God's business card says? It says John 10:10. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. But I came that you might have life and have it abundantly. You see, friends, God is in the resurrection business. By the way, the devil has a business card too. I don't know if you know that or not. He's got a business card. It's got the same Bible verse on it. My business, the devil, steal, kill, and destroy. But then you know what he does? He takes that business card, and when you're hurt, when you're in pain, when someone has betrayed you, when someone has really done something unbelievably rotten and almost unforgivable to you, when you feel God has left you and abandoned you, he takes his business card, steal, kill, and destroy, whites out his name, the devil, and writes God's name on it and hands it to you. And you think God is in the stealing, killing, and destroying business. And that is a lie. And you will recall when we started this business, back whenever we started this business, that the devil's only power was a lie. And to this day, that's what the devil does. Hands you his business card with a lie on it, that he's whited out God's name and put his name and put God's name instead. But God has a business card. God is in the resurrection business. And we need to remember that. That's what God does for a living. Okay? God takes all the dead things in us and brings resurrection. Important for us to remember. Okay, the next thing. Jesus is the bread of life. Joseph was the provider of bread for the world. Can't you see the parallels there? The next thing, Joseph is a man who was filled with the Spirit of God. Oh, geez, I wonder what that's like. Next, Joseph was seen as a judge, Next, Joseph was one who shows great mercy and grace. Joseph was one falsely accused by Potiphar's wife. Joseph was in charge of three households, first as a slave. Jesus is in charge of God's household as the Son. And while we're at it, what was Jesus' stepfather's name? Joseph. Both Jesus and Joseph were betrayed by a man very close to them whose name... Did you ever know what Judah is in Greek? Any idea? Judas. Yeah. Judas is the Greek form of Judah. Isn't that fascinating? That we're pointing to Christ in the story of Joseph. So, we come to the end. Not quite. The question is, how long would it take Christian people to figure this out? Do you think I made this up on my own? No. I present to you what was presented to me. I present to you the gospel as it has been presented to me, passed down from one generation to the next. The apostolic witness, the witness of the holy fathers that have come before us, that's what I present to you. None of this nonsense that you see bandied about here, there, and everywhere. I'd say this is the end, right? But it's not quite. So Joseph remained in Egypt, and he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation, and the children also of Machir, and the children of the son of Manasseh counted as Joseph's own. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones up from here." And so Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. I have a question to ask you. All good literature ends with the hero dying, right? And no resolution. Who ends a book this way? This is nuts. This is insane. The hero dies outside of the promised land, stuck his bones and body in Egypt with no resolution. I wouldn't write a book that ends that way. No. We're talking about this Joseph right here. Well, don't. You're getting ahead of yourself there. If you want me to be here all night, I can be here all night. I can do that. As I said, make no mistake, I can do that. Let's just stick with this. This is a rotten way to end the book. But further on, his bones get back. But what?
His bones get
back. No. You said something else.
Later on.
How do I know about the later on?
Oh,
there's more to this story.
Yes.
Wow, you mean there's more to this? Can I tell you something? By the very nature, this is not an unimportant point, friends. This is an extremely important point, and I don't want you to miss it. By the very nature, the literary form, no one writes a story like this. It's got to have more. You've got to have more, and I don't want you to forget this. Please, whatever you do, don't forget this. Say to me, "There must be more." Oh, scream it. "There must be more." Scream it. "There must be more." Okay, there must be more. There has to be more. There has to be something else that can't end this way. There must be more. There must be. It's not a separate literary unit. Yes, it is in the sense that it's a chapter, but there must be more. And with that, I shall ask, do you have any takeaways? Was there anything significant? Were there any unanswered questions? Or did we need something having greater clarification? Yes. Why did they put him in the cave? Okay, here's what a cave, this is what a grave looks like in ancient Israel. And even today, they you can find them, they're all over the place like this. They carve, either have a cave, or carve out of the rock this chamber. And in the middle is a pit, Sheol. And on either side are places where they put the bound corpses. And then they have a stone that looks like a giant thick quarter. Okay, it's a thick quarter, not a thin quarter, a thick quarter. And you roll this thing, and it's in a track. They've cut the track out of it. So this is stone. And they roll that in there. And you know what happens? You deteriorate. There's a great line in John chapter 11 when Jesus says, roll back the stone, because Lazarus is in there. And someone says, I love the King James on this, he stinketh. He stinketh. Well, that's what happened. Because you stink when you rot. But if you get really rotten, there's not much left soft tissue. There's only bones left. And what they would do is one of two things. Either they would take and put your bones in the pit and just kind of mix them down there with everybody else's bones. Or later on, they would take your bones and put them in what's called an ossuary. An ossuary was a bone box. And it was about half the size of the footprint of what you're sitting on, and about the same height right there. And they find these things all the time in Israel, and people's bones inside them. Okay, and that's what you would take the bones after a certain period of time, you'd go back and you would reuse this tomb over and over again. This is what happened with Jesus. I mean, it's the same. I mean, they've been doing this for a long time. And so if you ever go to Israel, you should go to Gordon's Calvary. It's not the official thing that where they say out Calvary, but Gordon's Calvary makes more sense than the official Calvary does. So, but that's why. That's why the cave, because that's how they buried people. They used it over and 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 over again. It's a reusable grave. Okay? How long does it take for your body to rot? I am not a mortician. The thing is, here's the interesting thing, because you're seeing two different things going on here. Well, I'll get you in a second. Yeah, the two different things you see are going on is, on the one hand, you're seeing how the Egyptians do it, which is trying to preserve this person for eternity. Then you see how the Jews are doing, and they're not. Now, this is kind of interesting. Do you know about Ezekiel chapter 38? Them bone, them bone,
yeah, I'm
dry bone, them bone, them bone, them dry bone, them bones, them bones, them dry bones. Now hear the word of the Lord. Because what's going to happen? He sees out this valley of bones, and he calls out. He says, "What's going to happen?" He says, "Well, you know, Lord, I don't know what's going to happen." And he says, "Well, you know." He calls out, and all of a sudden, the bones come rattling together. And then what happens is he commands the sinews to come on, and the sinews and the flesh comes on, and then he commands the breath. You know what the word breath is in Hebrew? It's the same word for wind and the same word for spirit. Greek the same way. And the spirit goes into them. Woo! Up they come. Up from the grave he rose with the resurrection. Because you know why? Because God's in the resurrection business. You see, it's a different metaphor of what these bones are going to do. The Egyptians, they embalm. The Hebrews, they don't.
And we cremate.
Well, some people do. Actually, cremation, don't put a quarter of me on that. Okay. Yes. Did you have another?
No, I was going to observe that in New Orleans.
Yes.
You know, they have
above the ground.
Because they can't bury them.
That's right. They'll rise.
Yeah.
Not like we want them to.
So they build these. I think it's called
sarcophagus. Yeah.
And their family.
Yep.
And so they put the body on the top.
Yep.
On the tray.
Yep.
They
open it up again.
They can open up again, and they pull the tray out, and the bones go down.
That's right.
And they're ready for the...
Yeah.
There we go.
There you go. There's your answer. Okay, other questions that were unanswered about Genesis. Yes.
You made a comparison between Judas and Judah.
Yes, because they're the same word.
And yet, the interesting thing is that out of the line of Judah came Jesus.
Yes, isn't that crazy?
It's ironic.
It's very ironic. God's a God of great surprises and a little bit of a sense of humor with irony. And that's what I was trying to point out, that throughout this whole thing, we kind of have the God's eye view of what's going on. They don't get to see what's going on, the whole story. We do, and there's irony, and there's comedy. There's all kinds of things that are going on. Other questions or big takeaways from our time together? Yes.
Here's a takeaway for me.
Okay.
So now we see what happened to the Israelites in Egypt.
Yes.
They're all of a sudden foreigners.
Yes.
You know, and they're made slaves. And,
yes.
And, you know, I'm going to think about the parallel between that and the United States today.
Okay.
In terms of foreigners here.
Yes, well.
We're discovering God. You know, there are a lot of people we don't want here.
Well, you know, it's funny you should bring that up. One of my favorite T-shirts is a picture of Geronimo on his horse, and it says Homeland Security since 1492. Just saying. You know, it's all in your perspective. It's all in your perspective. But yes, we sometimes worry about that. We do. A funny story about that. My dad, when he was dying, he was pretty upset because he didn't want anybody who didn't speak English to take care of him. And I reminded him that his grandmother couldn't take care of him then. She came to this country, didn't speak English. So, anyway, other takeaways from this. Yes. 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 Those two aren't in there.
Yes.
They're not. Very astute of you, because they already got blessed. Jacob already blessed them with that one that we went through about the shepherd. They already got a special blessing on them in advance. He adopted them as his own. He said, their children will be yours. So his grandchildren, he can count as his children. Joseph's grandchildren, and that's what it said at the very end, Joseph's grandchildren can be counted as his own children, but those two boys in particular are going to be Jacob's, and he blessed them in advance. Okay, yes, good point. Other? Yes.
And what was on the cover was in the ceramic?
Mm-hmm.
Skull and crossbone.
That I don't know. My dad on a landing craft. He was in the invasion of Sicily. And on a landing craft, he found a crucifix that was metal but had wood inside and had Jesus on it. Was out of metal? And I wish I lost it somewhere. But at the bottom had a skull and crossbones at the bottom of the crucifix. I don't know what was up with that. People do stuff like that. So anyway, other takeaways. Yes, Vicki.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is opening my eyes that the Old Testament has a lot more to tell us that the riches that we
have. Amen. The Old Testament, again, and Vicki, you are not alone. This, I would say that people are nodding their heads, that the Old Testament was taught to us sort of as, in a sense, that this is not really where we're at. We should be focusing on the New Testament and so forth. And actually, heck, they'll even hand out little New Testaments. Sometimes they'll throw Psalms. Sometimes, if they're being generous, they'll put Proverbs in there. But, you know, oh, don't worry about that law over there. But it's not. It's the Bible Jesus used. Got to remember that. The Bible Jesus used. That, yeah, there's all kinds of great stuff in it. Love it, love it, love it. By the way, just to let you know, next year, anybody know what next year is? The 500th anniversary of Brother Martin Luther nailing the 95, whatever it is. Yeah, 95 theses on the church door at Wittenberg. And you know what he was? He was unpopular. No, he drew the short straw in the seminary where he was. He said nobody wanted to do this, so he said, "Here, you do this." He was the equivalent of the professor of the Old Testament. If you look at Luther's works, he has 9 volumes out of 55 that were translated into English. 9 of them are on the book of Genesis. 5 of them are on the Psalms, 2 of them are on Isaiah. There's hardly any on the New Testament, because he could see Christ in the Old Testament as being the forerunner. So that's kind of interesting for us to see that. By the way, you really don't want to read his commentaries on Genesis, because he has a very, what's the word I'm looking for? He has a very pre-scientific worldview. When you see things in there, you say, did he really believe such craziness? Yes, he did. Like, for example, he believed that flies were sui generis, that they sort of just generated out of the dung that they were in. They just sort of popped out of it. They didn't know that there were maggots in there and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, all kinds of crazy things that he believed, which were typical of people who lived in a pre-scientific world. Yeah. So, other things about Genesis. Yes, Keith. Why not? Yes. 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 Well, no. Well, here's the thing. I guess you could call this a controversy. The question is, when Jesus came, did this end the because of him being the promise of the blessing through Abraham? Does this end the Jewish part of this? There are two schools of thought. One is the no school of thought, and the other is the yes school of thought. It's true. That's what it is. There's a no school of thought, and there's a yes school of thought. Imagine that. There is the no school of thought follows Romans 9, 10, and 11 in sort of indicating that that there's a special blessing that comes from the Jews, and they have a kind of their way in. John 14 seems to indicate that no, that's not true, that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except through him. We got to understand something, because we have a misunderstanding about some things. I'm going to say something even more controversial. There are people who are cultural Christians. There are people who are cultural Lutherans, in the same way that there are people who are cultural Jews, and the same way there are people who are cultural Muslims. Okay? A cultural Lutheran needs Jesus every bit as much as a cultural Jew or an atheist. Because if someone is simply living in the culturalness of something, that's merely the spirit of religion. And boy, there's plenty of spirit of religion to go around in Lutheran churches. I mean, plenty of it. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of it. It's not about that. It's about Christ. And see, that I you can kind of guess which I kind of fall into the yes category. But I respect the no. I mean, I'm not dismissive of the no's as being ignorant and stupid. I mean, there's biblical discussion that we can talk about in that regard. But it's a great question. But I think in Christ we have the culmination of it all. But again, we all have to look to Christ and Christ alone, not into our heritage, not into, because let's face it, Jesus, John the Baptist, when John the Baptist encounters the Pharisees and they say, well, we have Abraham as our father. You know what John the Baptist says? You know, hey, that's nothing, man. I can raise up from these stones, children to Abraham, better than you folks, than you punks. Punk. Yeah, really. I mean, that's kind of how it is. And the same, you know, we can't rely upon our fact that, you know, our grandparents founded, St. Sven and Ole's Lutheran Church in the homeland. We can't count on that. And that there are lots of people who do. Now, you know, you cut my arm, I bleed sola fide, sola gratia, sola scriptura. I'm a pretty Lutheran kind of guy. But counting on having our ancestors founding St. Sven and Ole's Lutheran Church is not going to get you very far. You need Jesus, just like everybody else. Other questions or observations or takeaways? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is one that we learned the last summer about the importance of observation.
Yes.
And there is so much to observe.
Yes.
Observe.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Isn't that, this is why I say the Book of Lamentations, lamenting, has one of the best passages in all of Scripture. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies, they never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. Studying the Word of God is something new every time you come to it. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that can come alive in it, and it's so cool. And by the way, thank you for the email. I did appreciate it. So, others, we have snackies. Anybody going to stay for snackies? Please don't make us leave without the snackies. Sandy, are the snackies prepared? The snacks are ready. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this time that we have been in a season in the beginning. Now we know that there has to be more. And Lord, if you will, in September, on September 14th, we'll kick it in again with Exodus chapter 1. In the meantime, we'll be doing the Apostles' Creed. You know that already, Lord. But if you will, we'll be kicking in and looking at more. But thank you for what we have received. Thank you for your word that has and gives life to this day. And thank you, God, that you are in the resurrection business. And all God's saints said, amen. Go get the stuff.